Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this panel on race and racism in America. I'm Scott Schaefer. And before we get started, I would just like to remind everybody, request that you silence your phones if you haven't done that already. This panel goes until 3:15, so we have about an hour and 15 minutes, and we're going to leave time at the end for questions, and I'll remind people when that time comes or before it comes, but you can line up over there, and somebody will have a microphone for you, and you can ask your question. All right. Well, this is obviously a very provocative time to be talking about race and racism in our country. So many things going on, and we're going to get to many of them, I hope. We have three very distinguished authors, and rather than having me introduce them, I've asked them to introduce themselves by way of answering this question. What prompted you to write this book, and what do you hope readers will take for it? And let's start right here on my left, Edward Ayers. His book is called The Thin Light of Freedom, The Civil War and Emancipation in the Heart of America. Ed, you're first.
Thanks very much. It's great seeing everybody. I'm amplified, yes?
Yeah.
I've actually been, you will notice that I'm a white guy. You'll maybe hear from my accent that I'm a Southern guy. And as soon as you realize those two things, you realize that there's history to be explored and talked about and thought about. And so I've written five or six books, and they're all wrestling with this problem. I finished a book that ended in the early 20th century, and a lot of it was about lynching and segregation and disfranchisement, but also about black aspiration and accomplishment. But then I decided, rather than going forward in the 20th century, I would go into the part that I intuited is always going to be a problem, which is the Civil War and the end of slavery. And it's interesting how often we segregate those two things in our mind. Civil War reads white. Slavery and emancipation read black. They're the same story. What is the Civil War actually about? The ending of the largest and most powerful system of slavery in the modern world. But we think of it as being like the gray team versus the blue team, you know, which general was, you know. But what it's really about was about the struggle with perpetual bondage in a nation that was built on the opposite of that, at least in its founding documents. So I came to this because this is the enduring problem in American history, and if we don't at least try to understand it, we're never going to be able to make any progress.
All right. Thank you, Ed. And to Ed's left is Julie Lithcott-Hames. Her book is called Real American, A Memoir, and it traces her personal battle with the insidious effects of racism growing up in a biracial family. Julie?
Hi, Scott. Thank you. Great to be here with you and Ed and Khaled. What prompted me to write Real American? I'm a 50-year-old biracial black woman, and this is a memoir about being black and biracial in a country where black lives weren't meant to matter. I am the descendant of a slave named Sylvie who was in service to her master in Charleston, South Carolina, the harbor town through which one in two African slaves arrived in this country, proclaiming on the one hand liberty and justice for all, and on the other hand enslaving my ancestors. And so I've called the book Real American, in fact, to pay homage to Sylvie, who was considered three-fifths of a human when they drafted the Constitution, which was her era. She wasn't considered a person. That three-fifths thing was really about the voting rights capabilities for slave-owning states. They considered her chattel, but she's my great-great-great-great-grandmother, and I call my book Real American as if to say, ain't I a real American? And didn't Sylvie make me a seventh-generation American? Yes, she did. I'm attempting to portray in this memoir that racism is agnostic to class and the degrees you have and who your daddy is. My father was Assistant Surgeon General of the United States of America under Jimmy Carter, and yet his daughter, me, I experienced the things we call microaggressions, the small, subtle acts of hate that make a person. feel less about themselves. And so I hoped that my book would resonate with people who've had that experience, who are black, biracial, people of color, queer, those of us who are made to feel like the other in a country ostensibly formed to be about all of us. I also hoped it might be a book that afforded people the opportunity to experience compassion for a life experience they have not themselves had.
Thank you, Julie. And our third author is Khalid Beydoun. His book is called American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots of Fear, and particularly as it relates to our legal system. And Khalid, why did you write the book?
So I think three salient reasons drove me to write this book. The first, growing up, I grew up in Detroit, which is one of the largest, most concentrated Arab and Muslim American communities in the country. And I learned early on that many of the scholars, pundits, individuals speaking about the Muslim experience were not Muslim and were largely white men. A scholar by the name of Edward Said had a really poignant quote in his memoir called Out of Place, where he writes, "I am an Oriental writing back at the Orientalists who for so long have thrived upon our silence." So I wanted to heed that call as a Muslim American and, you know, as a scholar, activist, advocate, really address what was happening in a multidimensional, textured way, especially with the rise of Islamophobia or the discursive perception that Islamophobia is rising with the emergence of Trump in the Trump moment. And that was the second reason why I wrote the book, is that I was getting a lot of interest based on my academic work, my public work. And I wanted to write something that was not academic in nature, that was not inaccessible in nature, and write a book that highlighted that Islamophobia, which was being framed as, you know, a modern novel phenomenon, was anything but. It was really anchored in centuries-long discourses, misillustrations, misrepresentations of what Islam was and who Muslims were. The third reason I wrote this book is that I'm a critical race theorist. As a scholar, I write in the legal literature known as critical race theory. And I was really keen on articulating Islamophobia as a legal system, as a structural and systemic system that was not aberrant, that was not deviant in the way it was being framed in the popular space, and something that is effectively powered, enabled, and facilitated by white supremacy. Making that connection was really critical to me, and that really drove my desire to write this book.
Thank you. Before we get started, I just want to let everyone know that I'm hoping that this will be less a Q&A up here than a conversation among the four of us. And so I've encouraged them to jump in. So lest you think somebody's rude or not waiting their turn, I've given them full permission to do that. And I hope you all do. So so many things going on right now, obviously. Voter ID laws, the Confederate statues, mass incarceration has become, you know, again, has been an issue for a long time. Black Lives Matter, police shootings, I mean, it's a long list. But to understand where we are, it always helps to understand where we've been and how we got here. And so I want to begin with slavery and ask each of you how you think our history as a nation and slavery being that original sin in the founding of our country, how has it shaped our views even today on race, religion, and what citizenship means? Ed, you want to jump in first? That's what your book's about.
Since I wrote about it, yeah. I mean, there's no understanding America without understanding slavery. It underwrote everything, including the wealth of the nation, but taken away from the people who created it. You know, we were chatting a little bit before. I don't want to step on something, but the response to the new museum about lynching in Alabama. And The Guardian had an article today about all the white people who resent that and saying, "You're just stirring up trouble. Why don't you just let that go and forget about it?" And that's the major problem, is that you have something that was foundational to the nation in slavery that we imagined was somehow not really American, and which is the way we teach the Civil War. It's like, I know it took us 250 years, but eventually they woke up and said, well, slavery is wrong, let's go to war to end it, which is just not the case. They went to war, and then slavery was a casualty of the war. So I think it's, you know, it's the most open secret in American history, but because we refuse to talk about it in any frank way, it just continues. I mean, it's going to haunt us anyway. I don't want to act like if we just said the right words, the burden would go away. But I'd say this, not saying the right words makes the burden even heavier.
Julie, you mentioned that your dad was a descendant of slaves. And I remember also in the book saying that you wrote that he hated July 4th as a holiday. But how did his history as a, you know, I think he was the great, 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 great grandson, maybe, of a slave, something like that.
Three greats. I'm the fourth.
Three greats. You're the fourth. Okay.
Yeah, I'm the seventh.
How did that, you know, color the way you grew up and how he talked about the family history?
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak of my father. He would have been 100 tomorrow had he not died in 1995. And his alma mater, Bates College, has just decided to assign Real American as their common read for this fall. So I'm thrilled that, it honors him. I feel that it honors him. So my daddy was born in 1918 in Oklahoma, or in New York, but quickly moved to Oklahoma. His daddy was a physician, one of the first black physicians in America. Came from people who were able to make a little bit of something out of themselves during those 10 or 12 years we call Reconstruction before the white folks decided, hey, wait a minute, this is not working out as we planned. And then the more covert efforts of the more de facto efforts of hate and terror began to put us back in our place. So my father is a second generation college educated African American who went to BU Medical School as his father did, right? All of these are firsts. My father fled the Jim Crow South to go to college up in Maine. He was advised to leave the South in the 30s when he was going to college so that he could have a chance at a decent education. My father was determined to make something of his life, spent his formative professional years helping to eradicate smallpox in West Africa, took his teenage children, my half-siblings, the product of his first marriage, took them with him out of the South, which is where they were coming up, Oklahoma City, to West Africa to remove them from the South as it was roiling in the 60s. They were there 62 to 69, and my white mother, who met my black father there, said to her, this is the first time and place I feel like a man. He was 43 when they met, and he was saying this to his girlfriend, who was 23, my mother. It's the first time I feel like a man. I'm here in West Africa, pretty dark-skinned for an American, pretty light-skinned for a Ghanaian or Nigerian, which were the countries they lived in. My father set out to become himself and to make opportunity for his children. His success led us to white towns. My father wanted to buy that house, thank you very much. He would show up at the closing and surprise them with the fact that the buyer was black. My mother was the one to meet with the realtors so that they would not be redlined out of opportunity to live where they wanted. They raised me in an all-white town. He worked for Carter. We lived in D.C., but Carter lost to Reagan, and we moved to Wisconsin, and I went to an all-white high school, 1,200 white kids and me, where I was student body president, and yet somebody wrote the N-word on my locker on my 17th birthday to remind me of my place. So that a slavery point, we may not be enslaved anymore, but this notion of whiteness being better than darkness, the lighter your skin is, the better you are. I'm up here with a lot of light skin privilege as a biracial black woman. That belief system is embedded in our systems, our structures, our policies, our minds, and our hearts. And if we do not do the work of unpacking the truthful trauma of that, we will never be, ever be, the nation envisioned in the founders' rhetoric and ideals.
Did your father move to those kinds of communities deliberately?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was trying to achieve the American dream, Scott. You know, he didn't want anyone to tell him where his baby could and couldn't go to school. He wanted the house with the lawn that he could be proud to mow with the big riding mower, only to have the neighbor across the street presume he was the gardener. It's funny, and it's also horrific when you hear the neighbor's kid tell you that, you know? So I think what he said to my mother, I want Julie to be comfortable with everyone, by which he meant white folks. In raising me in white towns, what that meant was I knew how to show up and survive and thrive performing the way white folks wanted me to in order to not be afraid of me and my hair and my skin and my ancestry. But they didn't raise me with the cultural richness that I would have gained having grown up around black folks. And my book is in part a depiction of that struggle to locate a black self I could love. Because I had not been raised amid black folks and was really raised with the stereotypes we all have about what's wrong with black and brown people.
Khaled, I think many people think of Islamophobia as having started on 9/12, 2001. Obviously, that's not the case. And as you point out in your book, something like a quarter of the slaves who were brought over from Africa primarily were Muslim, right?
Yeah.
So to talk about that connection between, we were talking about civil war history, but and also the roots of Islamophobia going back perhaps that far.
Yeah, there's this mistaken idea that Islamophobia commences in the direct aftermath of the 9/11 terror attacks. It's clearly weaponized in terms of the laws that are enacted, the structures that are put in place to grapple and police Muslim Americans afterwards. But the very roots of what we understand as Islamophobia today were firmly implanted during the slavery period. You know, folks don't know that 15% to 30% of enslaved Africans in the antebellum South were Muslims. Not only were they originally Muslims, they continued to practice Islam when they were bonded on plantations, when they picked, on the cotton fields, when they were really, wed to the most inhuman conditions we can imagine. And they continued to practice. They fasted for Ramadan. They set up the first makeshift masajid or mosques on these plantations. They were tended to be the most literate enslaved individuals because they practiced reading the Quran. They wrote letters back home to their family members in Africa. So Islam was central to their lives. However, the legal systems that were put in place, we all know that blackness was constructed as the antithesis of whiteness, and whiteness obviously was, at that juncture, was explicitly the legal mandate for citizenship. Citizenship and whiteness were conflated, and blackness was property. It was a term that was synonymized with chattel and property and so on. So the idea was that enslaved individuals could not hold on to faith. Right, they couldn't be religious beings because blackness was property. Juxtaposed with that is the idea that Muslim identity was racialized and constructed in the narrow form of the Arab, the Middle Eastern, and then the Turk, because the Ottoman Empire was, a geopolitical hegemon. So the slavery moment was critical in what takes place today with regard to how we see and with regard to Islam and Muslims, unsee black Muslims as being bona fide Muslims, because this idea that Islam and Muslim identity is a racialized identity is viewed to be irreconcilable with blackness, even though still today black Muslims comprise the largest plurality of Muslim Americans in the country, even though throughout the entire history of the United States, black Muslims have always comprised the largest segment and percentage of the Muslim American population. And I write in the book, really explicitly that you can't talk about Muslim America, you can't talk about modern Islamophobia unless you start with slavery and effectively anchor the Muslim American grand narrative in blackness and slavery as being the initial chapter. That's why talking about enslaved Muslims is the first chapter of my book.
When you think about the history of our country, from the founding to now, not only was there racism and Islamophobia, there was anti-Catholicism, anti-Semitism, Orientalism, and other isms. How are those, do you think, different and similar? What's the through line with all those prejudices and the discrimination? I mean, is there something unique to each of them, or what's the commonality? Is it the lack of whiteness, sort of, quote unquote?
Is anybody else reaching for the microphone? But do you want to answer that?
Yeah, do you mind? So I'm a lawyer, so I'm going to say that it's driven by law, right? And my position is that it was this idea of otherness being, framed in religious terms is a really critical conversation. We typically think about race as something that is physical complexion and phenotype, and that's it. But the construction of race is far more complex, far more nuanced, and is in fact driven by religious identity. There was a law in place that was enacted roughly 3 years after the enactment of the Constitution called the Naturalization Act of 1790. The Naturalization Act of 1790 mandates whiteness as a prerequisite for citizenship. Who knew about this law? Just a quick show of hands. Did anybody know about this law? Not many folks. When I was in law school and I first read this, I was floored. I was floored that for 162 years of this country's history, whiteness was a firm, full-fledged, explicit prerequisite to be qualified as a citizen. Now, what that meant is that whiteness meant something very specific and something far more narrow during these earlier stages of American history. Right, it was white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. Protestantism was a foundation, in fact, a gateway toward whiteness. And as a consequence of that religious sort of formation of white identity, individuals who weren't Protestant, Catholics like you mentioned, so Italian Catholics, Irish Catholics coming to the States were not deemed to be white. Jews for a long time, generally coming from Europe, were classified as non-white. Great book by a scholar named Karen Brodkin called When Jews Weren't White Folks. Karen was a mentor of mine when I was at UCLA, so I want to plug her book. It's a great book. But generally, whiteness was far narrowly conceived and constructed back in those days, up until the 1920s and 30s, than it is today. But obviously now with the reemergence of white supremacist movements, there's sort of a pivot back to constructing whiteness in a far more narrow fashion.
And was Reconstruction after the Civil War, was that sort of the beginning or an attempt to break down some of that? And to obviously, there was the 14th Amendment, the several amendments to the Constitution, which gave citizenship irrespective of race and voting rights, theoretically, as well.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing, is that without the 14th Amendment to say, if you're born in this country, you're a citizen, the things that are happening that are progressive now wouldn't have happened. But here's the thing. Why did the 14th Amendment pass? Again, it was not just like suddenly enlightenment came. It was...
We're down to one mic.
All right. I don't see a button or anything. I noticed it sounded better when they were talking. It's the mic. The 14th Amendment passed because the white South fought against the implications of emancipation in every way that they could. You notice that the 14th Amendment doesn't come until two or three years after the Civil War is over. Why is that? Because after the war, the white South riots in the streets of Memphis and New Orleans and enacts the black codes and does everything they can to erase the victory of emancipation. So here's the irony. They passed the 14th Amendment to say, if you're born here, you have all the rights of an American citizen. That is like a beneficent time bomb that's waiting. It doesn't actually have much consequence for the following decades of African-American history when those rights are neglected anyway. But what it does mean is that it's kind of like the founding words of the documents that we know are there that can be drawn upon when the time is right. But I think we need to be careful, is all I'm saying, is that Reconstruction began out of a very specific response to a very specific problem, which was the denial of any kind of humanity that people have been in slavery. It then, today, can expand beyond all that. I would just say one thing in addition to Colin's point. With race, there's a tendency then to with religion, there's a tendency to racialize it. That's how Irish people, who today, Irish Americans, would be seen the quintessential white Americans, but they were not considered white or even fully human in the early generations.
Julie, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think I can make this one work if I hold it close. Okay, so to all of this, I add, I'm not a historian. I am a lawyer, but I haven't practiced in 20 years. But, I bring this sort of just personal stuff to it, and what I studied coming up as an AmStud major kind of comes back for me now. This notion of the one drop rule. So there were a lot of people excluded at the origin, but then when the concept of whiteness was really created and honed and so on to ensure the perpetuation of a population of slaves. There was a law, I can't remember what it was, but at some point they created a law that said the child of the black and the white is the offspring of the mother. So that allowed white men to rape their black slaves, create a black child who would then be enslaved. It became this sort of reality that white men could have sex with whomever they wanted, and they did, and others were punished for having sex across racial lines. So the one drop rule perpetuated the population, grew the population of slaves. When enslaved people began to commiserate with indentured servants, like the Irish, who were terribly loathed, that's when folks swooped in to tell the Irish, oh, no, you don't need to get in with the black folks, the enslaved and indentured black folks. No, you're white. You may be lowly, you may have less, but what you've always got that they cannot take away from you is that light skin. And so when you hear today folks on Twitter who are Irish saying, give me a break, why are we talking about slavery? My people were enslaved too. Yes, well, you weren't enslaved here, but you were indentured. But when they invented whiteness and offered it to you and you took it, You could then start to walk the streets without that badge, that marker of brown skin color, to perpetually put you in a lower class in America. And that is something that is as important today in terms of who we value and who we don't as it was, I would say, as it was in during Reconstruction and as it was during the Civil War and as it was in times of slavery.
And this idea of citizenship, there's a moment in your book, Julie, where I think you're in high school and maybe it was a history class and one of your fellow students points out, you're talking about being president, who could be president, who's eligible to be president of the United States, and you're one of your classmate says, well, you can't be president. You were born in Nigeria.
Yeah, and I wanted to be president then, Scott. You know, I thought, like, hey, you know.
It's not too late.
I'm on track to be president. You know, no.
You were born in Kenya.
Right. I was born in Lagos, Nigeria, because my American... Right, and he wasn't born in Kenya either, right? I missed that. I'm sorry. Barack. Okay, right. So
I do want to get to that, though, but that, yeah.
So I always thought that I was a natural-born American. Was it an amendment in the which there's an amendment in the Constitution that refers to only natural born citizens can be president,
with some exceptions.
And I always thought I was natural born. Okay, I was born to a American daddy and a British mama. Britain didn't recognize citizenship through women then, so they weren't interested in me. But America recognized citizenship through the descendants of Americans. Now, I was born on Lagos, Nigerian soil, but I had to affirmatively claim that citizenship if I wanted it. I didn't by the time I was 18, which was the deadline. So my first passport at 4 months of age was from the United States of America. I was the child of a U.S. diplomat, you know, but birtherism... You know, raise the notion that maybe I'm not really a natural-born American. Mm. If I wasn't American, I was nothing. Okay? I was lacking in citizenship. Mm. Okay? Because Nigeria did not recognize me as one of theirs unless it was affirmatively asked for, because my parents were not Nigerian. Okay? Mm. So then this birtherism comes along and makes me question, wait a minute, you know, am I an American? That's another reason I call the book Real American. Right. Of course, Barack was born to an American mother, regardless of where you think his birth happened, which happened in Hawaii. But even if you think it was Kenya, his mama was an American. And I don't know how it is that in the context of the birther argument, nobody hammered that point. You know, I mean, that's his trump card. That's the trump card for that argument.
Yeah. We will get to Mr. Trump in a minute. Khalid, you mentioned in your book is very much about the legal system, and you know, as I think you pointed out, Ed, in your book, that you know the courts have helped institutionalize racism and segregation, as well as you know broken it up and said separate but equal is not equal. You know, this week we had the travel ban being heard by the Supreme Court, and it seems that they're unlikely to go against the president and his authority. But, you know, what are your thoughts about this kind of mixed role over time that the courts have played and continue to play?
So I can't be president either. I think I'm the wrong religion, Julie. So I can. I feel for you. Maybe we can run together at some point. That might scare the country, right?
Stronger together.
So the role of the courts has been, you know, central, and I think that, you know, in the book, I'm really keen on articulating Islamophobia as being a project that is in fact spearheaded by the courts in a structured, rational way. We think about Islamophobia as being irrational, but the objectives of Islamophobia and the very baselines are not only embraced by the courts, but are delivered by way of ruling by the courts. And I try to, you know, the law is hard, right? Obviously, it's written in a way that is not accessible. I try to translate it in a way for the reader that can understand what happened historically, but also what's taking place contemporarily with regard to the law. This past Wednesday, as Scott highlights, the Supreme Court heard arguments for the travel ban. Three renditions of the travel ban. We all know that, you know, Trump was keen on advancing this ban, and it became far more than just campaign rhetoric. It became very much a cornerstone of his entire campaign strategy. Now, I'll put my lawyer hat on. I teach constitutional law, so that's one of my, and I think you were talking specifically about Article 2. Article 2 specifically says that individuals, unless they're born in the United States, cannot become presidents. But my assessment of what the court and what's going to happen with the travel ban is a pessimistic one. It's a dismal one based on the arguments and the priority of the arguments that were made by the petitioner, right? It focused primarily on the plenary power of Congress to enact legislation in regard to immigration, and Congress has the ability to pass laws, either, you know, standalone laws or pass entire codes, like the Immigration Naturalization Act, which was enacted in 1952. And the fundamental question that was being argued is, how broad are the president's power to enact executive orders that are clearly discriminatory, clearly bigoted? And we could just, you know, basically look at Trump's rhetoric from the days he was a candidate till the days he was president to see that the objective of the travel ban was to prohibit the entry of Muslims. Right, he says to Anderson Cooper 5 months before he was elected, Islam hates us. He says on December 7th, 2015, when he introduces the idea of the travel ban, that it's an explicit, full-fledged objective to restrict the entry of Muslims until we know what's going on. Now, the reality is this, is that there's a preponderance of individuals behind the bench, justices, who we classify as originalists, who don't care about what Trump said, don't care about the rhetoric, even though this rhetoric qualifies as an admission, right? These are admissions that his objective in extending this order was to restrict the number of Muslims coming in, which is a white supremacist sort of objective, right? We want to maintain the white majority, the demographics of the country, and one way we're doing that is to limit the entry of Muslims coming into the country. The entire focus of the court was the text of the order, the text of the ban, which can be read, unfortunately, as not being religiously discriminatory and is effectively excising everything he said beyond the four corners of the ban itself.
Just sticking with the courts, the 14th Amendment has been used to build upon equality in this country, most recently, I think, with the gay marriage, extending gay marriage rights to same-sex couples. And yet, because of this debate within the Supreme Court, you know, with the originalists, the strict constructionists, and the, you know, more the folks who think it's more of a living, breathing document and has to change with the times, I mean, this is still very much an argument. And I'm wondering, to what extent do you think, depending on the composition of the court, could it go backwards in terms of civil rights?
Certainly, it can. How you do that? When you think about Plessy versus Ferguson, that enshrined separate but equal, what's their argument? And correct me if I'm wrong, but not right here. Wait till later. is custom dictates that people of different races, as they saw it, were separated, and therefore the court is not going to override local custom in this regard. The 14th Amendment ends up mattering only because the black freedom struggle makes it matter. It's not that the Supreme Court just goes, what were we thinking? It's because it was used as a weapon to basically shame the nation to do it. So unfortunately, law seems a highly pliable vehicle on this. It enshrined segregation with the national sanction, but then it could be turned against that entrenched segregation because it was law at some point.
Well, and we're seeing that a little bit with the cake case, the baker who didn't want to make the cake for the same-sex couple, you know, religious freedom versus freedom of expression and so on. Julie, you wanted to say
something? Yeah, I just feel like we search for objectivity and truth, but in reality, we're all biased as hell. And, you know, I mean, the people who study innate racial bias say we've all got it. We all absorb the narratives. We all absorb the imagery, the stereotypes that our national narrative has constructed and offered us, you know, by a steady diet, asked us to ingest this, and it has become part of us. You know, I was sort of, when I was listening to Ed when he first spoke, he said, you know, we think of the Civil War term reads white to us, whereas slavery and emancipation read black. And I thought, well, it depends on who us is. Because to white folks, it may read that way. But to me, Civil War has always meant black. It has always meant, you know, a pivotal time when something changed a complex period of time and a complex change. But I've always equated the term civil war with slavery and emancipation. But that's just a question of who are we talking about? Whose perspective are we talking about? You know, the strict constructionists have their sense of how the Constitution ought to be looked at, not even interpreted. What did they mean? Strict construction, original intent versus the living, breathing people. Well, I tend to side with the living, breathing document people because the strict constructionists, how do they reconcile the three-fifths thing? You know, how do they reconcile that so much of the formation of this country did not contemplate that someone like me, female and black, should have any rights? You know, so I tend to be on the side of the people who see me as people, you know? So, to our present moment, crack versus meth and opioids, crack users, addicts, criminals, throw them in jail, lock them up, three strikes, gone. Opioids, meth, what a tragedy. Oh my goodness, look what's happening. We need funds, we have a public health crisis. Give me a fucking break. These are humans resorting to taking drugs because they have terror and terrible things in their lives, and we criminalize one set because they're black and brown and poor, and we have compassion for the other because they're white and poor. You know, I mean, this is welfare, you know, welfare queen versus came upon hard times, you know? New Orleans, Katrina, look at them rioting, you know, look at them stealing from the store versus look at those people who found a loaf of bread to feed their family. It all breaks down on the basis of race and other categories in which ways we otherwise people, such as their religion. So I don't know where I'm going with all of this, so I'm going to hand the mic over to Khalid.
Do you want to say something? Well, you know, one thing I just want to pick up on that sort of, which is to say that you know, racism isn't obviously just a black-white thing. There's racism within the African American community. There's racism within the Asian community directed at other races. I remember when Barack Obama ran, there were some African Americans who said he wasn't black enough. So what's the difference between those sorts of attitudes and the other kind of racism? Is it a spectrum? I mean, what is it?
Yeah, I think race and racism is really complex, right? I think that the way we can distinguish racism as it happens on a macro level is that there's real power behind racism as it's deployed by the state than when racism is sort of, you know, functioning within specific communities of color. I tend not to think, and correct me if you guys disagree, or, you know, tell me if you disagree. I don't think it's racism when black folks discriminate against black folks. I don't think it's racism when Arab folks discriminate against Arab folks, when Latino folks discriminate against Latino folks. I would classify it more as, you know, sort of intra-prejudice, and in fact, it sort of takes place more along the lines of colorism. Right, I think Julie spoke earlier about the idea that there's, and it's tied to white supremacy, right? So the colorism and the intra-prejudice that takes place within communities of color is in fact closely tethered to white supremacy and whiteness being deployed and weaponized by the state. Because we can think about it from the days of slavery, or we can think about it on a global level, the way colonialism functioned. If you turn on, I don't speak Spanish, but I'll turn on and watch Univision for no reason, right? I like the music or whatever, I like some of the shows. You always find that Latino folks who are showcased on Telemundo or Univision are always light skin. That's also true for the Arab world. If you turn on Arabic television from Egypt or from Saudi Arabia, wherever these shows take place, the folks are always really light skin, right? So I consider that to be an issue where there's a real sort of fixation and love of whiteness that is effectively seeded by colonialism. However, it's enabled by white supremacy either in the historic form or in the present day form. Because colorism, the way it unfolds today in the United States, is also tied to a legal white supremacist project. Recall that whiteness in this country was once a legal mandate. In order to become a citizen, Arabs, Latinos, a whole host of immigrants, Jews, Irish folk, had to persuade somebody at a border, a patrol checkpoint, or a civil court that they were in fact white. So today when we talk about aspirational whiteness, which is very much the driver of intra-prejudice and colorism within communities of color, it's closely tied to the law on one hand, and second, it's closely tied to these, you know, really broad, systematic, psychological, existential projects that we can classify as colonialism, which are still taking place today. I think one thing that is a real misnomer is that colonialism is sort of this arcane project of the past. It's really critical, really critical. And I talk about this in the book, how colonialism is also still a psychological and an economic project. When I go back home to Egypt and visit family, let me tell you, when I walk into the pharmacy, the first thing that I see are these skin bleaching creams, right? Skin bleaching creams that my cousins will buy because they feel as if their skin being too dark is not attractive. When I was young, I had a cousin of mine in Hem, who's roughly my same age, always talking about her not being an attractive sort of prospective bride because she was too dark. My grandfather comes from the south of Egypt, Aswan. He has Nubian roots. And she would perpetually buy the skin bleaching cream, which was doing significant damage to her body and doing greater psychological damage. If you go to India, if you go to Pakistan, if you go to countries in Latin America, these skin bleaching creams, right, and there's like 10 or 12 different brands, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. So when we talk about racism taking place within communities of color, it's important to understand how it's closely tied and perpetually sort of deployed and manufactured by white supremacist enterprises and entities.
I would add, I think, you know, I couldn't help but notice when we all sat up here that, you know, we're all, you know, pretty similar in skin tone, that it's a shame we didn't have darker black and brown folk up here on the panel. I want to acknowledge that. The second thing that I want to say is, yeah, someone wanted to applaud that, right on. The second thing that I want to say is, to me, and this is not my definition, but the definition of racism that I've read and appreciate is that it's really bias plus power. So in our inter-community conversations about black enough, too black, et cetera, we are not wielding power against one another. It is more subtle. It is about belonging and lack of belonging and legitimacy and so on. But there isn't, I believe, a systemic exclusion that's going on within our community based on our skin color. And our identity, you know, I think when we're conscious of our blackness, we recognize that regardless of how dark or light our skin may be, our blackness is about a committedness to uplifting the quality of life of black people.
Well, and Julie, in your book, one of the lines in one of the chapters is, I'm quoting here, Mom was the blackest white lady I knew, maybe even the blackest person I knew. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is, so I have this white mother from Yorkshire, England, who married my African-American father and gave birth to me. And because my father traveled all the time for his work in public health and academic medicine, and they were raising me in white towns, my black parent was absent doing important work in his profession. And so it was left to my white mother, who's British, not even American. She comes to America, gets naturalized. I'm like, I'm her anchor baby, okay? you don't talk about that with white folks, but my immigrant parent is a white lady from England, and she was left to try to help me construct a healthy cultural sense of self, though they were raising me in white towns. So it was black dolls, it was Nikki Giovanni poetry, it was posters on the wall, and I credit her for trying, and really I'm angry with my father, who should have known better, for deciding to move us to white towns. Unfortunately, Daddy's been gone for 22 years, so it's my white mother I argue with as I have come to consciousness about the harm of that largely white upbringing.
Because this,
despite my mother's best intentions at being as black as she could be without actually being black.
Because this is being recorded and because I'm a radio guy, I'm going to reintroduce folks for those who may wonder in the middle of listening to this who we're listening to. Julie Lithcott-Hames is author of Real American, a memoir. Khaled Bedoun is author of American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots of Fear. And Ed Ayer's book is called The Thin Light of Freedom, The Civil War and Emancipation in the Heart of America. We're talking about race and racism in America. Ed, you live in Charlottesville, Virginia, where, of course, the white supremacy rally shocked people in some ways in its overtness and the willingness of Klansmen and others to, you know, no longer wear white hoods, but to, you know, wear, I don't know what they were wearing, but, it looked like regular clothes. They weren't ashamed to be white supremacists. What's going on?
What is going on?
Yeah. Well, I'd say this. I mean, not that I'm touchy about it, but this is why I'm saying the Civil War reads as white. Okay? That people showing up, they own a Robert E. Lee. Okay? Robert E. Lee is the embodiment. So that's what I meant when I'm saying reading is white. You know, Charlottesville is you know, really liberal place. I also live in Richmond, which is a very liberal place. Both these, you know, Virginia's blue, both senators, governor, everything. So Charlottesville was vulnerable for its very, it was targeted because it was seen as a place where a bunch of liberal city council members were going to subvert what we're talking about here, that the birthright of whiteness, that if you, and the terrible things that these white supremacists were chanting, you will not, Jews will not replace us. So, and seeing the Nazi flag carried with the Confederate flag punctured so much of the defense of the Confederacy as being sort of a distillation of American values. So I think it was a, and then of course President Trump's response to it, everybody being sort of bad people on both sides. I'd like to think that that little town suffered for the good of the nation in some ways, in the sense to see that displayed with the tiki torches and the khaki pants with such undisguised hatred and virulence, I think it's got to be a wake-up call for the whole nation. You know, I had to go on, I didn't have to, but I was invited to go on PBS NewsHour the day after Heather Heyer was killed, right where she was standing, and try to explain this. And here's the tricky part. What do these statues mean? Why were they put up? And to understand that they were put up by sons and daughters of the Confederacy as a kind of heritage, which is true, but the political and social meanings that they had, which are also true, I'm on the commission in Richmond to figure out what we do with Monument Avenue. And of course, we're so hedged in with all kinds of laws and legislation about what we can do, but the way that people, and to Julie's point, just read our entire history from different starting points. A lot of these folks say, it's history, it happened, get over it, which means it's the history that we claim as ours, shut up. Okay, so that's what's at stake. It's a claiming of who we are today by claiming who we were in the past.
Can I ask a question? You probably, yes, Ed, I think you probably have the best sense of this. Oh, you may not.
I'll answer anyway.
Well, it's a broad question. Awesome. What other nation, in what other nation are there monuments to a people who wanted to undo that nation, to secede from it? I mean, that to me is the utter idiocy of the fact that in our moment we have statues proclaiming the greatness of those who sought to secede from this nation and create their own nation, warred against us and lost. I'd love to know if it is true that elsewhere on the planet there are grand monuments to those who tried to undermine the very nation the monument sits in.
I do not believe there are. And here's what I do. So I'm out, because I'm on this commission now, I had to sort of not express, maybe 3,000 miles away, I can't, but there, people say, what do you think about all this? And I said, look, I'm a civil servant right now. My job is to make a recommendation to the mayor and the city council. Whatever you say, here's what I'm going to do. I'll argue with you. So people say that, and I will say, well, the argument of the people who celebrate Lee and Jackson and all these other guys is that they were, A, following the Constitution, and B, they were defending entirely American rights of self-determination, is what people say. That it was not treason. They deny the fundamental premise on which your statement is based. And so that is, and I would say the thing that I point out to them, there's so much focus on the motivation of the people. They were good Christian, and you hear this a lot, and that they were good slaveholders, or Stonewall Jackson taught slaves in Sunday school, and all those kinds of things. And so when I'm playing the role of disagreeing with people, I just say, yeah, and what would have happened had they won? The creation of the fourth richest economy in the world based on perpetual bondage, explicitly acknowledged in its constitution. But so it's to your point. In all of these, the stories that we're telling, we shape the story to support whatever we want. What white people are wanting with the statues is a pristine white heritage that's untainted by guilt, whether for treason or for slavery or for race.
And that's what this is really all about. And in Charlottesville, what they were chanting, you will not replace us because we are the embodiments of the real America.
Do you think that because of Charlottesville, and maybe there was some momentum before, which may have led in part to what happened in Charlottesville, have we turned a corner in terms of these monuments and this question of whether they belong? We've seen in New Orleans, for example, the mayor taking the statues down and giving a speech about race, and now he's, you know, frequently talked about as a potential presidential candidate. And let me just add one thing to that sort of assertion. So the National Memorial for Peace and Justice opened officially this week and in Montgomery, Alabama, and the Montgomery Advertiser, the daily newspaper there this week, had the whole front page was 313 names of African-Americans lynched in Alabama with the headline, Time to Face the Past. Now, I don't know enough about the politics of that newspaper. I don't know if that's a transformation or not, but, you know, what do you make? I mean, is there a alternate conversation happening as a result of what's going on with Trump? And
I'll just make a really brief comment to bridge to what I was saying. So we've received about 1,500 letters and emails at our request about what Richmond should do with the monuments. The great proportion of them say we have to do something. I don't know what it is. I do think the Dylann Roof massacre in South Carolina and the Confederate flag was sort of a gateway toward thinking about the monuments. I don't think there's been a great conversion, but I do think that people are at least willing to think about the people of goodwill. But it's not clear. I mean, the argument there is these statues need to stay there as a reminder. Go back to your point, Julie, about people taking statues down. Stand there as a reminder of what happened. And this, what we find is that this doesn't map on black and white. It maps on age. Younger people just like, what? Why would you even think about it? And that's Landrieu's great rhetorical maneuver. How do I tell a young African-American girl what this is for? We find that older people of lots of different backgrounds are saying we can't really do anything about it. Young people say, why the hell not?
Yeah, Julie, call it.
Yeah, you know, I guess this is kind of like loosely germane to the question, but it's kind of jogging these ideas in my mind. I think the next book I want to write about is Neoliberalism from the Left. Naomi Klein, who endorsed my book, might be mad at me, but this is kind of reminding me a little bit about how progressive politics are becoming really performative, that we're focusing specifically on language, we're focusing specifically on symbols and symbolic sort of gestures, juxtaposed with a moment where policies, laws, eyeing in on racial justice have been gradually retrenched and eroded, right? So even though there's a sort of like, you know, visible swelling of progressivism from the left, and some might even say radicalism from the left, that is indeed sparked by the Trump moment, that is indeed sparked by what took place in Charlottesville as a reaction, we have to understand that for the last 20 years, behind the bench on the Supreme Court, through legislation and so on, that the cornerstones, the very cornerstones of a racial justice platform have been entirely eroded, if not dismantled. We can think about it in terms of affirmative action. Right? So affirmative action has been entirely gutted by the Supreme Court over a 3-decade period. And it's really important to understand how the jurisprudence around affirmative action is enabling this neoliberal moment coming from the left. And I may, my editors here, maybe it's a book I can write next. I might be happy to. And even more than that, voting rights, right? So voting rights have been entirely eroded and gutted, especially for poor Black and brown people. And another thing I think that we've neglected to discuss on this panel is class. What is the importance of class when it intersects with racism and race? The idea that poverty obviously intensifies, in my opinion, and exacerbates how racism is experienced, whether it be with regard to Islamophobia, anti-black racism, anti-Semitism, and all the isms that we can talk about and write about. But, you know, my fear is that I think the Trump moment and the rise of white supremacy and its neo-forms has mobilized the new sort of reaction from the left, but it's not the sort of reaction that I think has yet to challenge these policies coming into play, these systems that are coming into play that are really bludgeoning specifically the civil liberties of the most vulnerable elements within communities of color. So I think that I'm not trying to underplay the importance of the removal of these statues and these memorials. It's a really critical thing because they live on as memorials and sort of direct reminders, especially to black people, that you were once property in this country. And there's residual effects of slavery that we can talk about all day long. But I think beyond that, right, beyond the sort of surface issues that we've been fixating on as a country, the rhetoric, right? Everybody knows what intersectionality is, but if you test people as to what it actually means, only 20% get it right, right? Because I think we're so focused on the surface, the rhetoric, the performances, that while fixating on these things, the right is actually carrying through much of this really damaging legislation that is really intensifying racism, which on the ground is enabling the rise of white supremacist movements in a really frightening way.
I think you make an excellent point about the left being caught up in dealing with symbols and bringing flags down and removing statues and ignoring this gathering storm that were the erosion of rights. I do want to say that the American narrative has largely not included so many of us. You know, history, they say, is written by the victors, and we are in a moment where we are recognizing that and bringing more folks' narratives, you know, to be woven into the American narrative. They're building a museum to descendants of African slaves in the Charleston Harbor that's going to cantilever out over the water a bit to honor the fact that, like it or not, this was Ellis Island for the descendants of one and two African slaves. And I think that's important. And the Lynching Museum, I hope, will go beyond listing names and having imagery to represent people, but also make sure that visitors know that white folks used to bring their kids to lynchings and sell candy because it was something to enjoy. And I think if we don't stare that outrageously horrific truth in its face and call it what it was, we do not heal from it. So I do think there is value in these examinations, and yet Flint still doesn't have drinkable water, and voting rights are being eroded, and mass incarceration is a reality, and these are just some of the political and policy-based injustices that are very much a part of our present moment and are not solved by the removal of statues or the erection of museums.
Ed, before you... Just want to remind you that we're going to have you, if you want, ask a question. You can line up over here. We'll bring a microphone over there. We'll get to that very shortly. So if you do have a question, feel free to line up against that wall. Ed?
Just a very brief comment in support of what both my colleagues are saying. Interesting to think, and this is my own ethnic identity, Hillbilly Elegy, basically people who have been white for centuries but seem to be falling behind in some ways are racialized and all this. This is these people who, with every advantage, they're the ones on the drug. It's just interesting, the popularity of that trope of hillbillies being, it's their own damn fault. Not that the economy was collapsing underneath them. So I mean that in support of your comment about class and interpenetration.
Can I respond to that really briefly?
Yeah,
so Julie made a really poignant sort of historic point that is really relevant to your mention of Hillbilly Elegy, right? So I read the book. It was a great book, beautifully written, the conclusions I disagreed with. But when you said earlier that when Irish were organizing with black and brown people, that there was a reminder from the higher-ups, the gatekeepers of whiteness, that you are in fact still white, that discourse is still taking place amongst the population we classify as hillbilly. Right, so even though your economic condition is similar to poor and black and brown people, you still hold the highest currency in American society. You're white. Your economic circumstances effectively trumped, right, no pun intended, by the idea that you are still white. So these historic discourses that we talk about when whiteness was in fact a legal mandate to citizenship, and when whiteness was being brought in to include Irish folk, Italian folk, Jews into the fold, is still taking place today. Right? With poor whites, because whenever there's efforts to effectively, you know, bring solidarity or forge solidarity between poor whites and black and brown people, there's demagogues on the right, whether it's the Tea Party or whether it's Trump, to remind them, you know, why do you want to get with these guys?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter that you're on welfare. It doesn't matter that you can't afford to pay your mortgage.
At least you're not a...
Exactly. At least you're not at least you're not a Muslim. At least you're not a Mexican. Right? So that's a perpetual sort of wedge that comes from the right and sometimes the center, in fact, and sometimes the left. These historic discourses are still percolating and still deployed by not only demagogues, but mainstream politicians all the time.
All right. I am happy to take some questions. I can't tell. Are you standing? No, you're standing, but you're not wanting to ask a question. Okay. But are we going to bring one of these microphones over? Okay. We've got at least one person. Why don't you come to the front so it'll be easier for us to reach you with the microphone?
She'll handle the mic.
Yeah, I think so you don't block anybody. Maybe just, yeah, there you go. Back up.
This question is for Khalid. You mentioned at the beginning that you have a significant interest in critical legal theory. And because I'm fairly ignorant, I have no idea what it is, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah. Well, y'all want to explain what it is?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm a critical race theorist, which is a tradition within legal scholarships launched effectively, spearheaded by a man named Derrick Bell. And it was continued on by a range of academics that you might know, Kimberly Crenshaw, Cheryl Harris, Devin Carbato. Kim Crenshaw is my mentor. So basically, just to kind of summarize what it is, it's a reading of the law to effectively claim that the law has always been used as a tool. There's this idea that the law is neutral, objective, and so on. But the law has always been used as a tool to not only legitimize racial inequality, but to also create racial classifications, to also justify and endorse racial stratification. So it's a sort of jab, a direct punch at the myth that the law has always been neutral and objective and been fueled by race and racism.
So my question is kind of rambling, so I'm apologizing preemptively. So something I've noticed, you know, when we go to protests is we chant, no justice, no peace. And recently in South Africa, you know, you have students protesting the statues of Cecil Rhodes because he was the progenitor of apartheid. And, you know, recently their parliament made a decision to redistribute land to black people, and then you have white landowners panicking. So something I'm wondering about, I guess, is, you know, what does justice look like? And this question is specifically to Julie and Khalid. What reparations does the American empire need to make to people who it has oppressed and marginalized?
Yes. So what does justice look like? I'll lead with the idea that it's also key to kind of frame white supremacy as an economic system. And right, to sort of like also, you know, intersect it with this neoliberal moment where we're so fixated on diversity, multiculturalism, and appearing as if we're sort of this progressive, you know, accepting nation. Unless we begin to frame justice as economic, I think we're doing a disservice in framing what justice is in a very narrow and myopic fashion. So getting to your question of reparations, I think it's important that our framing of justice includes not retrenching, but in fact expanding the sort of programming that the Supreme Court and legislators and other powers that be are doing their damnedest to do away with. Programs like affirmative action. Remember, affirmative action at its earliest onset was aiming to do what? Right? Address and redress past and present inequality. The Supreme Court rules in 1978 that it can't do that anymore, that the objective only becomes diversity. And who does diversity benefit? Especially at elite colleges and universities like UC Berkeley across the country, a student body which is largely white. So affirmative action becomes a program that is effectively spawned to address past and present inequality. And I think it's important to sort of frame reparations in a broad way to include projects and interventions like affirmative action. In addition, beyond that, reparations, I think, I would agree with somebody like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who says the state has to extend robust reparations to the descendants of African slaves. In whatever fashion, I think, you know, we can argue, whether it's the creation of institutions, whether it's writing checks, but whatever the fashion is, I think that we need to move beyond this neoliberal moment where we're framing anti-racism and justice in ways that are only effectively window dressing, right? They have to be done in ways where we're creating really robust inroads, opportunities for the most marginalized groups to actually partake in enjoying the economic dimension of what it means to be American.
How beautiful. I first heard of reparations when I was a law student, and Charles Ogletree was my mentor, and he was talking about reparations back in the early 90s, and it frightened me. It frightened me that we as people, as black people, might be so audacious as to claim that we did in fact have the right to ask for redress for what was done. By which I mean it frightened me to think of what they might do to us if we began to ask for reparations. Mm-hmm. And I say to you as I sit here on this panel, I am more afraid today of the gun-owning right-wingers who think their moment to reclaim their country is coming. They think the Second Amendment is for the kinds of things they feel are eroding their country right now. I find myself feeling terribly afraid that they're going to rise up and create those militias and become those people to use that Second Amendment for these purposes. So wherever I might be in my heart around reparations and the obligation to redress the past, I will admit to you that it scares the living you-know-what out of me. What might come en route to potentially getting reparations. I will frame it differently. I'm not saying I don't believe in reparations. Do you understand me? I'm saying I'm frightened to contemplate America in the process of allowing that to be so, although philosophically I believe it should be so. I am interested in economic policies that value all humans. I am interested in a living wage. I am tired of hearing radio reporters interviewing people, not tired of hearing the reporters, but tired of hearing, I love Scott Schaefer, the stories about, well, you know, they're talking about Ben Carson, who's head of housing and urban development, has decided he wants to have a policy that everyone's got to work if they're going to live in a project. So then they interviewed someone in Atlanta that has a local project about you want housing assistance, you also have to have a job. And they interviewed the lady who runs it and said, how's that working? She said, well, most of our families only make minimum wage, which is not a living wage. So, you know, even if we make them work, they still can't afford to buy a house here. I want policies that make that untrue. I want education that educates all children, you know, to a level of consciousness and awareness, regardless of their status, socioeconomic status, or their skin color. I want people to be able to live where they are and be safe in the streets and not have their journey down the road be impacted by the color of their skin. I want us to undo our implicit racial bias so that my black son, who's 18 years old, doesn't have to be afraid of police, doesn't have to be afraid that when he's holding a cell phone that they think it's a gun, as is happening still. And yesterday, just in Atlanta, I believe it was, you know, they got a black man down on the ground. The five police officers had him handcuffed, thought his cell phone was a gun, and they were beating him, and someone was taping it, and then one of them realized he's an ex-NFL player. And they said, please don't press charges, and please don't release this video. Okay? This is the kind of, I am interested in our present life circumstance not being worse or better on the basis of our skin color. These are words that echo what Martin Luther King said, right? I am not naive. I'm not saying I want to be race blind. I'm saying I want us all to be able to get an ice cream and have children and find work that aligns with our skills and our values and find love and ultimately die peacefully rather than at the hands of someone who hates us on the basis of our ancestry and skin color.
Hi, I have a question, comment, mainly for Khaled. You talked about colonialism, and within this framework, I'm a little bit surprised that we don't talk about the fact that the white Americans came as colonizers here, and we don't talk about the Native Americans. They are the big absence. So could you comment on that?
So I try to talk about it as much, and I talk about the experience of natives, you know, in the book. I think that, but I agree with you. I think that in the popular discourse around race and racism, that's a dimension of the entire narrative that is regularly, you know, erased from conversation. And I think you're right, and I think it really, you know, pertains to the discussion that we have when we think about rightful ownership and who the rightful citizens of this country are. There are indigenous people, and not only indigenous people that we tend to think about as a monolith, right? Indigenous people in this country were immensely heterogeneous, were immensely diverse, and, you know, populated this country in beautiful ways that we need to celebrate. So I try to uplift that story as much as possible as a scholar, as an activist, and to, you know, work. I'm an activist as well. I work really closely with Native activists in Michigan, specifically around issues committed to racial justice. But I agree with you. The broader point is that, and I think it's legally devised in a way to erase discussion of natives. And part of that is a reflection of the law, right? Remember, the racial taxonomy in this country, right? It's a spectrum where blackness occupies one axis point and whiteness occupies another axis point. When the framers of racial classifications and the taxonomy we talk about devised the American racial system, they viewed natives to be entirely divorced from it. They had no classification because they were deemed to be subhuman and savage, a population that they wanted to exterminate, not include as part of this racial continuum. And that's why. That's why we tend to think about Native folks in this country as a bygone people, as a population that is entirely divorced from discussions like this, because, again, it's rooted in the legal system, which then spawns the way we talk about it politically and historically.
Hi, this is directed towards Julie, and I'm very curious about the answer, and I hope that it doesn't come out as offensive at all, offensive. You said that your parents are white and African American, and I'm curious why you identify as a black person. Is it because of that one drop of black makes it black? In which case, that would probably not a very that's not something I think you'd probably ascribe to. Or is it because people look at you as black? And is it not just as empowering to say that I'm white or I'm mixed race and I don't care what you look at me as? I mean, I just want to know, because Barack also identifies as black, and I've always been curious about that. So.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I don't know Barack. I wish I did. But if I knew him and had this conversation and I asked him that question, I think he would say I identify as black for many reasons, one of which is when I walk down the street and try to get a cab, I can't get a cab because they see me as black. Now, of course, he's been president of the United States, so presumably that helps. Although, who knows? You know, Barack could get pulled over for his skin color before they discovered he was black. It may be true that people have thought I was white. No one has ever, to my knowledge, confused me for white. The messaging I got growing up, I'm light-skinned, obviously. I speak this way. I often, you know, confuse people over the phone, then they meet me in person, and they realize that I'm non-white. They know I'm non-white, even if they can't figure out what I am. I identify, my parents and parents like them were told, when you have a child, raise them as black, because America will see them as black, and they better be black and proud. And that's a wisdom that held in the early 70s when I was coming up and holds to this day. My parents made the mistake of raising me in an all-white town, so there was no cultural validity to that claim that you are black. There were no teachings, there were no mentors, there were no peers. So I was labeled as black, didn't feel black, was the only black kid in my town, felt different, felt odd, felt judged. When they offered biracial as a, you know, as a verbal option in the late 80s, I clung to it as a way to no longer deny my white mother. But I realized now I was running from black because I didn't feel black, and also I didn't want to be black because black is bad in America. I have since come in my 40s, I'm now 50, to locate a self I can love as a black, light-skinned black woman who is biracial and has a white mother. The people who have most always claimed me and embraced me have been black people. So fundamentally, my identity is a function of where do I find belonging and community? And I have not ever been embraced by white folks the way I am by black folks.
All right. Well, we are just about at 3:15. I want to thank all of the authors, Julie Lithcott-Hames, Khaled Badoun, Ed Ayers, and their books. Their books will be out in the lobby, and I'm sure they'd be happy to sign any of them. So thank you all for coming.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.